vocal voices of the progressive movement of India, stressing on the need to uphold rational and struggle for scientific socialism as opposed to pseudoscience and religious as well as academic obscurantism. He will be talking on the topic Science, Environment and Society, Emerging Lessons. He'll be talking for around 40 to 45 minutes, and we can have a small Q&A session for which the chat window in the voice channel titled Study Class English can be used. Professor Jayaraman.
Okay, so let me start. I'm very happy to be here on this evening session of the Bodhi Commons. It's very creditable that the Bodhi Commons has organized this series of lectures. And I am equally impressed that there are so many of you who are willing at 9 p.m. in the evening, a somewhat unusual time, to be online for such a lecture. We do live in unusual time, so I guess one should not be too surprised. As the reference in Abid's introduction has made clear, I will be talking about science, environment and society. And some of the emerging lessons with particular reference to the current COVID-19 pandemic. I will not be referring in the talk to people like this K.K. Agarwal, who is really a weird sort. And it is quite shocking that he has been past president of the Indian Medical Association. But then we all recognize that we live in times when unreason and superstition or plain nonsense has taken the place of science and rational thinking. And in the context of the ongoing pandemic crisis, this is extraordinarily bizarre. It is always bizarre, unreason of this kind. But this is extraordinarily bizarre because on the one hand, all the measures that are being taken, all the talk that is going around in the media, the entire public discourse is all about acting on the basis of the best available science that we have on hand at the moment. We need not pretend that we know everything. The scientists themselves are clear that there are things which are known, there are things which are unknown. There are disagreements, genuine disagreements about scientists, among scientists. But yet at the same time, everything that we do is built around acting on the best available science. At the same time, this is also open season for all these bizarre critters that some of them we didn't even know were around in our society, if I may say so, coming up with the weirdest notions about what is happening, about why this pandemic is occurring, what we need to do, and so on and so forth. India is not unique in this respect. This is happening the world over. But what some people on social media perhaps have called in a related context, Morona virus. The Morona virus seems to be as serious as the coronavirus in our country. But I'm not going to talk about this in today's lecture, nor am I going to talk with particular details of the ongoing pandemic and the corresponding social and economic crisis that we face. For one, I am not an expert in many dimensions of this issue. And particularly at this delicate moment when we have to act in as collective a manner as possible, it's very clear that one must be careful and responsible. So since my expertise does not relate to that, that is not quite what I'm going to talk to. And we certainly are not going to be Agarwals ourselves. But there are larger issues about science, environment, and society, as I indicated, which arise from some, shall we say, taking perhaps a more reflective attitude to what is going on around us. So we are not going to talk about how much testing, what kind of mask, do we need to wear masks all the time, you know, what is the progression of the epidemic, all of those things are not on the agenda today. But a more reflective and broader view of the subject is what I am aiming at, and that is certainly what I am qualified to talk about. So let me get into the subject right away. So before I go on to talk about other things, let me make some remarks about the notion of the environment. But the first thing that I would like to point out is that the term environment is an anthropogenic term. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that if we had did not have the presence of human beings, we do not have what could rightfully be called an environmental question. We would have biology, certainly. We would have physics, we would have biology, we would have chemistry, we would have evolutionary biology, we would have zoology, botany, whatever. But we would not have an environmental question. The environmental question is an intrinsically anthropocentric term. It relates to the role of human beings situated in nature. What do we mean by nature here is something we need to talk about, but there are other such anthropocentric terms that we use. A very favorite example of mine is, for instance, disaster. So if a branch falls from a tree, that is the natural biological process. After all, if a branch dies out and it is no longer getting nourishment, then it dries up and eventually, for one reason or the other, it will break and fall. Now that's a biological process. But if you are standing under it and it falls on your head, that's an accident. That's a disaster. So there are storms which affect no one. In the middle of the sea, they come and go. Those are storms. But if such a storm strikes Chennai or Kolkata, then you would have a disaster. Climate change is also a global warming. And in fact, the scientists are quite careful, the careful ones, that is, to call it global warming or anthropogenic origin. You have global warming on Venus, the planet Venus. The atmosphere is a good example of runaway global warming, but we don't think we have a convention on climate change sponsored by the United Nations for Venus. So climate change, when we say, generally speaking, we refer to the Earth, and we refer to what happens in the context of human beings. So as I said just a couple of minutes ago, one of the issues is the way we use the term nature. So in one use of the term nature that we are familiar with, we refer to things like the laws of nature, and in a very general sense, we refer to nature and or we say this is how nature is, for instance. In all these cases, One is referring in some sense to an objective reality, physical, chemical, biological, geological, whatever, if you wish. Not social, though. There, the use of the term nature is somewhat more problematic. But in other senses, we are referring to an objective reality. There is another sense, though, when we talk about environment, there's another sense in which we speak of nature. And that is the biological and geological world that we live in and experience. Now, the first use of the term nature and the second use of the term nature are not two entirely different things. They are obviously related. But in the use of the term environment, more or less with some qualifications, the world that we live in and experience and interact with is what we refer to as nature. And of course, as part of this, it is when we say experience, this experience is not simply in terms of sensations. It is experience that is mediated by our thought, by our culture, by our fact that we are social beings. So we have, when we talk of nature, there is an aesthetic dimension. We talk of the beauty of nature. There is an appeal that snow-capped mountains or green meadows have that is undeniable. So, you know, there is this sense somehow of nature, the lived in and experience mediated by our social and cultural views of it. This is very much the nature that is often in question when we are talking about the environment. So the environment is about humanity and nature, primarily in this sense. So as I have said, they are related, but we should not quite think that they are totally independent. Nature in this sense, in the second sense, or the environment, if you wish, one of the important things to know is that they have always been transformed by human activity. There is very little of the earth. There are, of course, some regions. All of you would have heard about the Amazon River Basin, the forests in Western Africa, like in Rwanda and so on, or the Congo, parts of Indonesia. These are three of the great repositories of what you might call, within quotation marks if you wish, untouched nature. So very often there are indigenous peoples who live in these areas, and in that sense, even that nature in those regions is not untouched by human activity. But in the rest of the world, there is nothing that has not been touched by human activity. And this transformation of nature by human activity goes back in time. There was a time when it was survival. We have all then the domestication of the domestication of flora and fauna. I must emphasize flora, not just fauna like dogs or horses or cattle, but also making plant varieties, you know, usable by us, transforming them to our purpose. So we begin, in a sense, as if we are part of nature. There is a long prehistory where humanity is barely distinguishable from animal life. But with the arrival of, with the combined consequence of both labor and consciousness, humanity is transformed as an active presence in nature, where humanity learns to distinguish itself from nature and to make nature not the, so to speak, the precondition of human existence, but you take it that it is the presence of nature that sustains human life. So it is, if you wish, the presupposition of human society. Nature is transformed into that. So you take agriculture after a while for granted. Without agriculture, there is no human society. But that's a real forward step, if you think about it, from the period of hunting and gathering, which even if you going by some contemporary views, which even encompass the Neanderthals and not necessarily Homo sapiens. So, or modern humanity. So, but there is the next stage, which is, of course, the more intensive use of nature. Nature become much more a part of the warp and woof, so to speak, of the sustenance, self-sustenance or self-reproduction of society. Of course, there is a real point of transformation when this really takes a forward step in an accelerated way, rises to a new qualitative level, and that is with the rise of capitalism. Let me say that capitalism does not equal the Industrial Revolution. Capitalism is, a way of structuring and creating the way labor is organized in society. But once that stage is set, then comes a real transformation. First the development of the Industrial Revolution, and then the development of the Industrial Revolution, so to speak, in agriculture. And here is where I think the environmental question rather obviously acquires its sharpness. Okay, it's a bit, I must say, it's a bit odd to speak to an audience without seeing anybody. This is like sometimes in class, where I think I am referring to a PowerPoint and the PowerPoint is not on the screen for the last 20 minutes, and then I turn around and look and the whole class has been looking at me and not at the PowerPoint because there was no PowerPoint. So I don't want to not have an audience like that. Anyway, to move on, that it is modern science that has decisively changed our notion of the environment. And you cannot underestimate this. And this viewpoint that is common among a certain section of environmentalists and so on and so forth, that somehow there are various views of the environment that are all on par with each other, why privilege one or the other. Now, it's very difficult to take such a notion seriously. I must say that, it is true that indigenous peoples have lived with a rather close knowledge of weather and seasons and broad changes in climate, have reacted to it, but have done so without, in some sense, have done so in an experiential way, without quite always deciphering what is going on. They recognize patterns, etc. But it is clearly the presence of science, our development of modern science, that has decisively changed our notion of the environment. And I must say this is true even in the social sciences. Anthropology's view of the material dimension of environment and culture, the relationship. For anthropologists too, it is very, the ideas of ecosystem or ecology, etc., have also changed their view of the way they regard tribal societies and so on. So without the so before that you had this a romantic view of the environment. You know, there were you know, some attempt at a scientifically precise view took a lot of time for us initially to get there. For instance, attributing diseases to bad air, you know, until we found that they are active agents that are the causes of diseases. And so eliminating these active agents or finding a way to neutralize their action is the key to better health, and not simply, you know, better view, etc., or, you know, cleaner air, though all of that is beneficial. But the transformation from a romantic view of the environment to a scientifically precise view is what has made the environmental question what it is today. We can discuss details if people have doubts, etc. So in some sense, you do not have an environmental question or a understanding of the environment in a modern sense until in the industrial era. But there is clearly here, there is a confusion which is very particular to the environmental question. And that arises from the fact that when you talk about science and technology, particularly technology, on the one hand, the Industrial Revolution led to new forms of pollution. There's pollution because through the knowledge of physics and particularly chemistry, in an earlier era, we made things and materials of which, you know, that which were not available in nature. For instance, all dyeing of clothing, etc., referred to used raw materials from nature and processed them in order to make dyes. And this was what was used for coloring, like indigo, which was grown in India. But the, you know, the discovery of aniline dyes and, you know, the whole chemistry of dyeing and the variety of paints, etc. Though Renaissance painters, etc., had some knowledge of this, but that whole leap that the chemical revolution, so to speak, brought, produced a whole new class of materials that were never known to nature, not in that form, certainly. And so, you know, in the modern era, you have plastic. Plastic is a polymer. Polymers are known in the chemistry of life in various ways. But at the same time, we created polymers that are no analog in nature. So this creates a new situation. Nature, as it were, if you had thought was pristine, was quite obviously no longer so. The world around us is surrounded by things that humanity itself has created. So, you know, some people call it second nature, perhaps there are different names for it, but we make our own nature. So if you wish, when you talk of the urban environment in particular, you talk of living in Mumbai, you talk of living in New York, you talk of architecture, you talk of all these things, then it is the environment around us is our own creation. It is the consequence. But at the same time, these consequences are all not anticipated beforehand. There are intended consequences. All technology has an intended consequence. You don't make a chair by hit or miss. When you want to make a chair, you know you are going to make a chair. So technology is purposeful. But despite the fact that technology is purposeful, it is not all the consequences of technology are not obvious to us. And this is very relevant to the questions we confront today. Similarly with science or any artifact, anything we discover, any law, any... So for instance, sometimes it is good. Like for instance, you discover lasers and afterwards you find that, you know, there are a vast variety of uses for lasers that we did not even think of. That the certainly the discoverers of the laser had no clue that these were possible. On the other hand, you have all kinds of other things you did not anticipate. Like you find, you discover antibiotics and of course, they are a wonderful thing. Penicillin was a gift. Previously, you know, you could die shaving. You cut yourself while shaving, you could die. But then, you know, antibiotics made all the difference. But then we discovered antibiotic resistance. You know, we found blood transfusion, but then we had to discover the fact that there are things called blood groups and there are, you know, the rhesus factors. So there is no way, and this is something fundamental, that all our knowledge in any given point of time is finite. That's as it is. That is so. I mean, what else is there to say? But nevertheless, the world itself is infinite. So finite knowledge in an infinite world means that you can never predict the future. The idea of having a kind of certainty about the future is basically a theological idea. So, you know, You are scared, you know, you confront the unknown with fear. Science does not confront the unknown because it is deterministic. That's a very outdated notion. No scientist seriously thinks so. In fact, if we knew everything ahead of us, if science were always about the future being deterministic, there would be no idea of doing research, for instance. So science cannot predict, but so whatever scientific or technological advance that we make at any given point of time, there will always be a class of issues or problems that we would have to confront in the future. Now, facing up to this, I think is central to the issue of science and environment. There is, however, one dimension of this which we should not forget is the fact that while the knowledge and the activity that constitutes technology is social in character, nevertheless, for the bulk of the from the period of the Industrial Revolution, technology has always been privately owned. So, you know, so they are property. So the knowledge sometimes itself is property in the form of patents, but certainly the machinery, the goods, but it is the labor, whether manual, technical, or intellectual, that makes for technology social. So this leads to a certain confusion, and this is because the ownership of technology is tied with the making of profit, and that is what capitalism is all about. And so it is in this sense that, you know, there is a contradiction here. There are many dimensions to this, all of which I'm not going to talk about. But there's just one particular one, which is about environmental risk. So when as the scale of production has increased, okay, one also realizes that the technology whose benefits in the sense of profit making, etc., that governs their deployment and use. This is private in character, but the risk associated with it is socialized. So, for instance, there is a long record of companies, you know, firms and enterprises that refuse to take responsibility for the environmental causes, consequences of their actions. And if they are asked to change their ways by society at large, very often it is the implications for their profits that determines a large part of their reaction. And that is true to even today. So some of it, of course, is this risk is so that does not mean that even firms and enterprises are always aware of the dangers they cause. So you might argue that, you know, even in the 19th century, because of the globalization that the world was familiar with, you know, the control of diseases, the word quarantine goes back, as I was checking today, I was wondering where that word came from. So the original quarantine period in the period of the plague was 30 days, and it was referred to in Italian as Trentino. And then there was another, I forget, I can't quite pronounce it, a complicated word which was had the root quadra in it, referring to 40 days, and some combination of the two became quarantine. So quarantine is an old thing. In fact, as my student who was working on it pointed out to me, that the control of the livestock disease in India had to begin fairly early on because of its implications for the global trade and the way it would transmit through shipping. Now, you might argue that, you know, airlines should have been aware of. But, you know, airlines are not like ships, you know, so they are not like cattle ships. So you don't think diseases travel by air. But very quickly, after a while, we find out that traveling by air is all very nice. You go from here to there in the literally the blinking of an eye compared to what was true in the past. But nevertheless, you carry all your diseases with you, well, as we are finding out in COVID-19. So that's the point I want to emphasize. Now, within this sort of attitude to environment, there is so people react to environmental risk in different ways. So there is an attitude of not taking it seriously. And this is really an well-ingrained attitude among the capitalists, for instance. They will say, well, eventually we find out that some solution will be there, but who bears the burden in the meanwhile? So that is one attitude. Of course, when it hurts their business, they are rather more serious about taking risk seriously. But in a lot of the population, especially if the more distant science is from them, and even in well-educated societies, this is not too far away, one is governed by fear. One is governed by noting, you know, trying to blame someone, trying to find a cause. You know, we have a problem with uncertainty. The other problem we have very often is with uncertainty of a different kind, namely, you don't know a cause, where accident is the crux of it all. And this is very true of epidemics and illnesses. So very often people say, you know, when in India, it's still very common to hear, you know, if someone has a tumor or cancer, for instance, some form of cancer, they say, no, but we are a good family, we always were healthy. But cancer strikes by accident. There are cancers which are behaviorally or environmentally caused, but there are cancers which simply arise and one doesn't know the reason. And so this inability to account for accident, and then of course you have to blame someone. And so you blame, traditionally we in parts of the world they blamed witches. Even today it happens in parts of India. But in other places, you blame people of a different race. You blame anyone who looks different. So, you know, so the coping with uncertainty, especially about the riskier the event, the greater the level of risk, and the more immediate and the more sort of unexpected it is. So nobody would blame, for instance, members of a particular religion for floods. But in the context of epidemics, blaming sort of communalizing the spread of the epidemic comes very easily. So, you know, so that's a real problem. Within this, there is another dimension, and that has to do with a peculiar sort of fascination of environmental romanticism, if I may call it, for agriculture. So, you know, so the romantic view of nature, pre-scientific, that I referred to earlier, its last refuge is really agriculture. So for instance, there is a mythical farmer. Mythical because this is not really true anymore in practice anywhere in the world. There is a mythical farmer who lives in harmony with nature. Okay, if you're a farmer, you'll know, you know, how much harmony is there in nature, and you know the pest, the insect, the weed, the weather, all of them are enemies that you battle constantly. But no, there is this romantic view of the farm, close to nature, at one with nature. And the other related thing is the insistence on purity and cleanliness of food. This is not necessarily just in a country like India, which has a lot of semi-feudal residual views of purity of food. This is also true in the West. In fact, it seems like their version of a kind of neo-Brahmanism, you know. If you go on social media or on the internet, or if you have lived abroad, you will know how there is a section of society which is simply obsessed by the purity or quality of their food. And so, you know, there is this whole classic story of how the discovery of DDT, a pesticide commonly used in the breast milk of mothers, was a sort of, it really had a resonance. It's like something pristine and pure, like mother's milk, you know, was being polluted by pesticide. Though after all these years, it's not very clear that the appearance of traces of DDT in mother's breast milk constituted any kind of particular health hazard. I don't know, maybe because it was taken off, we didn't see its impact, whatever, but there is no clear connection which has been established between any disease or any problems that arose from this. So this has transferred now to a sort of blanket rejection of all that it takes to grow crops to feed the world. Pesticide, insecticide, GMOs, you know, you name it. And you know, there is a sort of peculiar Frankenfoods, you know, you sort of, you create scare words to point this out. Now, a lot of this is said, no, we are doing it because we are against agribusiness and so on and so forth. But it's not about agribusiness. A lot of this is simply has to do about industry and not about who owns it. All these issues have a little bit come to a head, and it's very amusing to see it in the context of the pandemic that is around us. So I've already about 40 minutes into the lecture. So let me briefly talk about this and sort of provide the context to some of the things, a more immediate context to some of the things we have been talking about. One, of course, is the stark fear of the unknown. And the moment there is the fear of the unknown or a fear of something that is unexpectedly difficult, problematic, threatening, then of course you have to blame someone. This is true at the global level, and it's all about, say, China. China was responsible. You know, if you look around the world, you look at a lot of diseases of this kind which went from one country to another. And the Europeans took smallpox to the Americas and wiped out the indigenous population. So it has happened. And I'm never very sure about the historical veracity of it, that they took infected blankets and handed them out, etc. I'm not an expert, so I leave it to the experts to decide whether that's true or not. But, the other as the source of the epidemic is something that is so palpable around us, is like a textbook come to life. Part of it is, of course, simply wounded pride. You can't imagine that a country like China capped its debt toll at some figure, and some of countries at the heart of Europe like Italy and Spain or the United States have surpassed it or will be surpassing it in their debt toll. That's something they find very difficult to accept. But that aside, I'm not so, that's a little more obvious perhaps in a certain sense. But this is really the need to find a cause. Now, very interestingly, the whole point about an epidemic is the unconscious and the accidental that are at the root of epidemics. Otherwise, there would be no epidemic. It is this, even before you realize it, the transmission that takes place. So, like Dr. Well known to me, my brother, in fact, pointed out that, when you realize that a new disease is afoot, which is threatening particularly, you find that there are a cluster of sometimes deaths that are not very expected, or they cluster together. You find people dying of respiratory ailments in a particular unusual rise in that number. There are reports that this was happening in Italy as far back as November or December of 2019. So you don't know that there is something going around. It is in this sudden appearance of something standing out from the background, which is what tells you that something new afoot. So, blaming someone for it, of course, you must be careful, take precautions, etc. But there is no way you can, that's precisely what makes an epidemic an epidemic. So while you take precautions, these identifying of blame, laying blame is something that's very obvious here. And alongside, of course, the reversion to the theological, and a lot of this theology, there is a sort of secular theology, if I may call it, is very popular in environmental circles. Instead of God punishing you, they say nature strikes back. So there is a almost theological reference to nature. But that's always been true of nature. If you build a building carelessly, then a cyclone will rip it apart. So over years, over centuries, we have learned to build buildings that can withstand the attack of cyclones. And even then, when sometimes we feel we have done the best possible structures, comes a cyclone which is unprecedented, say is never seen before for 120 years, and that will take it apart. So nature strikes back is true of anything. You know, all cyclones carry the power of several hydrogen bombs, for instance, if you want that kind of analogy. There is no predicting earthquakes. So what do you call tsunamis? Tsunamis are what nature striking back. So, you know, if you have a tsunami, then coastal structures are destroyed, you know, ports, buildings, etc. are destroyed. So you say how the sea came back and reclaimed what, you know, it's all theology. It's always been there. So if you have the unexpected is dealt with in this kind of reverential terms. But the whole history of humanity, and if you wish in particular, the role of science and technology has been precisely to overcome that fear. You will know, of course, there are times, you know, that you will know that here is a force you cannot overcome. That is why you do your best to get out of the way, like this, you know, movie Perfect Storm and things like that. You see people trying to get out of the way. But nevertheless, that uncertainty is very much part of it. So we have this whole reaction, nature strikes back. But what is very surprising, what is, you must remember, is a somewhat absurd thing. Because we are not living in the era of the plague. We are not living in the era of the Spanish flu. We are able to deal with this pandemic in a much better fashion than anything you could have done 100 or 200 or 300 years ago. So you have this sort of romantic past where there were no problems. And now, of course, you find there is this gentleman called Rob Wallers, who tries to argue that as if it is capitalism alone, which is, you know, it's capitalism that is responsible for the epidemics we see today. And by capitalism is not very clear what he means, because whether he means technology or the fact of who owns the technology. I'll come back to that in just a moment. So, alongside this nature strikes back view is this sort of, you know, nature as Pandora's box. And there is this fear and fascination with the exotic. And the real focus of this, you can, the real one version, one kind of language where you can see this one discussion, is when people talk of the wet markets of Wuhan. First of all, the term wet market, as if there is something. In India, all markets are wet. I've never seen a dry market in India, excuse me. But if you talk about wet markets of Wuhan, something strange, you know, with creepy, crawly creatures all wandering around. Basically, wet markets means anything where fresh meat and poultry or so. On the one hand, you are against industrial agriculture. You are against frozen food. You are against processed food. On the other hand, you sell fresh fruit and you sell fresh poultry and you sell fresh, pork or beef or whatever, or mutton. And then, of course, you call it a wet market. You know? So there is this somewhat contradictory reaction. And with the touch of the exotic East. So they eat pangolins, you know, they eat God knows what, snakes, you know. So there is this exoticization. And in fact, if you go around the world, and there is, some of you may have seen this, what's this guy's name? Zimmerman, who goes around eating quote unquote exotic foods all over the world, you know. So my daily meal is your exotic food. So, and associated with this, this new sort of scaremongering word called zoonotic diseases. Zoonotic diseases are basically diseases where the pathogen that affects humans has an animal host. That's all, that's what it is about. Now, rabies is very old. It's a well-known zoonotic disease. Only thing is, we found a vaccine for it, or we found a way to cure it. The moment you have bitten by a dog, you can get this anti-rabies injection. Or anthrax. So, you know, so there is a wide variety of zoonotic pathogens which are have been dealt with, and they have been around for a very long time. Now, if you want to describe the agriculture of the mid-19th century as industrial agriculture, that's certainly a bit stretching the case. So, in fact, zoonotic disease that occurs to me as I speak could be positive. For instance, cowpox, which led to the vaccination for smallpox, is a good example of zoonotic illness. So, now this term zoonotic illnesses, zoonosis, has been sort of blown out of proportion. And that's really, you know, the point is, and so all this is tied up in the argument with productive agriculture. The environmentalist contribution to this discussion is the attempt to tie all of this up with industrial agriculture. So the whole point about it is that productivity is a necessity for human existence. We need productivity. If you admire the streets around you, which are empty in these days, you might possibly admire also the peace and quiet of the graveyard, because it is the graveyard of society. If there is no productive activity in society, society is pretty much, you know, in very bad shape. And we cannot continue like this for a while. To be productive is to be human. So I think that is, the new problem we have is trying to link some of these issues to concerns of productivity and so forth. And that is where I think a lot of the confusion arises. Now, I think I have been on for some time, and perhaps towards the end I have not been as clear-cut as I would have wished, but I'm going to stop here. But just to point out on the large scale that there is an issue of preparing for epidemics. I'm not saying it is a non-issue. To prepare for the unexpected in improved ways as our knowledge of science and technology proceeds is important. The second point I want to emphasize is that, I see from some of the chat that people are worried that I have missed it. No, I think a society that is not based on profit and accumulation would be far better off, far more capable of dealing with the environmental question than a society founded on accumulation for private gain. But having said that, I think we must be careful not to reduce all problems to that. And this is partly my complaint about David Harvey, Rob Wallace, Naomi Klein and a lot of others. And they are joined by far more non-left, more right-wing personalities who have a stake in the climate change question, etc. So I would just remind them that, well, in the Soviet Union was pretty bad on questions of the environment. And for very much the same reason as people like David Harvey today, because they don't see the importance of the autonomous issue of science and scientific knowledge. And both sides, I think, both these historical examples made the common mistake of reducing everything about the science and environment to the question of social and economic relations. So let me stop here, and if the organizers will tell me some way I could answer the questions. Okay.
Thank you, Professor Jayaraman. We have some time for questions. Some questions, as you can see, have appeared in the chat window. Would you like to read it yourself, or do you want me to read it out for you?
I can see. So, okay. Very good. There were peeping people, at least coughing on chat. Thank you all those who were coughing on chat. So let me take Sheila's question. See, it cannot be ruled out, she says, that workers stand to be are in fact being harmed in overwhelming numbers by the production processes that we have in place. Yes and no. I'm not so sure that it is. See, there is no comparison between the Mr. Henry Ford's Model T and the modern factory. There is and there isn't. And that's the contradiction which is important. It is not a black and white. It is true that capitalism always makes workers work harder. And the need to squeeze labor power out of the working class is always there. But at the same time, it's also true that to say that the factory of today is like the factory of 100 years ago is simply not correct. There is capitalism is, of course, always tempted to go back, if you wish, in time, in terms of rights. Amazon is a fantastic example. You know, they make workers work so hard that, you know, people have to wear diapers because they cannot have a bio break, for instance. But having said that, if you think Amazon is simply the employer of old and nothing has changed, I think that is different. In fact, a journalist who I like very much, who writes pretty trenchantly about this, Leigh Phillips, he points out, for instance, Amazon is a great example of why socialist distribution can work with the modern IT, with all kinds of developments that have taken place. These supply problems which used to plague the Soviet Union can be taken care of, and people like Amazon have shown the way. So the whole problem there is that what is possible, the potential of science, is not realized. So I think I don't know quite a mainstream environmentalism. I must say that mainstream environmentalism is characterized by a strong disdain, if you wish, for the workers. Who else would think that lockdown, you know, oh great, the air is clean. I mean, it's polluted by the cries of starving workers, if you ask me. So I think my problem with mainstream environmentalism is that, in fact, it pays very little attention to social justice, economic justice. It pretends that the righting of environmental concerns is fungible with economic justice, And that is not at all obviously true in a number of cases. So I think that would be my statement. But I'm not saying my point about, of course, the workers' take in this is science. That's my point. I think the workers' take in this is science and rational organization of production, not the blanket critique of productive activity as a whole. I don't want to get into climate change. My colleague Tejal will be on in a couple of days, so she'll go at it hammer and tong. So I'm going to leave climate change to her. But I do agree. This is Azad Ardi and saying agriculture is severely hit and can use BT to produce crops that can stand the rise in temperature. I think we should. I work in an institution, M.S. Swaminathan Research Foundation, where colleagues from an earlier period have produced saline-tolerant varieties of paddy, etc. But because of the effectively blanket ban on testing, they have not been able to do it. And this is, using GMO not for biotic stresses, but for abiotic stresses. So I think we have a problem here. And without science, you must appreciate the contradiction. On the one hand, without science, you wouldn't even know that global warming was happening. Then you turn around and say science is the problem. There's an obvious contradiction here people have to sort out. No? Somebody is asking, is considering plants and animals as a form of machines a good way? Not at all. Short answer. I think it's very problematic, and the modeling of biology by mathematical models, biological processes by mathematical models, suffers in some sense this infirmity. There are some nice works on it, and there is a biologist called Daniel Botkin, Botkin, who has written very nicely on this. There is a documentary titled All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, something like that, All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, which has a very good critique of the very mechanical underpinning of the idea of ecosystems, for instance. That is a very interesting critique. So if you take a look at it, we need to, it will give you a good viewpoint on that question you asked. This is Shibi. Nuclear energy, no. I'm not going to get into that one. Yeah. When you say wrong to blame, no, I'm not saying. See, but there is a point I was trying to, this is somebody whose handle is cash. He says wrong to blame only capitalism. I'm not saying that. There is clearly, whether one likes it or not, there's the difference between Germany and its handling of the COVID-19 crisis and the United States handling of it is very clearly due to the nature of the public health systems in the two places, even though both are capitalists. Even that little difference makes a huge variation. And Italy, very few people, I think, have noticed. Italy, for instance, has only one-third the number of ICU beds that Germany has. And I clearly think that this is because in Germany, for all their leadership of the EU's monetarist policies, nevertheless, at home, there has been some balance in providing for public health, whereas Italy for 20 years has been in the hands of a bunch of jokers, each one more right-wing than the other, which have really let the country down. And now you see it, one-third the number of beds, ICU beds per 10,000 of population. So capitalism is very important. This is ridiculous. You have this extraordinary sight of in Nevada, I think the homeless need a place to sleep. So they have been marked squares on an open car parking lot, and they are all sleeping in the open, maintaining social distancing. This is disgusting. So of course capitalism is important. But in the rush to call it capitalism and to see where capitalism is part of the issue, you should not take away from the autonomous and important role of science. Okay? And it's not all capitalism. And so one has to be careful about that. And this also partly answers Jayesha's question about my disagreement with Klein and Harvey. So Harvey somehow simply does not see that, you know, between the Spanish flu and today, there's a whole big deal of difference. There is a difference. We had the plague in Surat. The plague in Surat is not the Black Death of 400 years ago. So capitalism has a role to play in its completely contradictory fashion. How capitalism is the basis on which contemporary science and technology has developed. One has to appreciate that. And that I find completely missing in Klein and Harvey. Bellamy Foster is a slightly different problem, but let's not go there. Oh, Anuj says, does any of this talk matter? Well, if it doesn't, it doesn't. It's an evening talk, 9 p.m. T. Jayaraman sounding out. No, I'm kidding. See, that's again, this is the same point I'm making to the same question being carried on. It's not all about transnational capitalism. Without transnational capitalism, you don't have mobile phones. You don't have the internet on which you are typing without transnational capital. What are we talking about here? They control trillions of dollars and drive international economic policy how they want. Yes and no. There is not everything in human affairs. Otherwise, there wouldn't be crisis. They would take care of it. They don't want crisis. Capitalists don't. No capitalist says, oh, great, lovely, let's have a recession. Recessions are things that happen even though capitalists don't want it. So their science is important. I agree, science, which often gets a bad rep, is simply exploited by those in power. Yes, I agree with that. Openness in research. Do you think private funding, not just private funding, also national state interests, etc. A state funding alone can cut down on the private funding in the research fields. If all research were publicly funded, that would be lovely. And we'd really get going much farther on a lot of very important issues. In general, I think it is best, research should be public. But many people think that somehow modern capitalism in the neoliberal era has made delinked science from the interests of capitalism. That is a slightly different question. I don't want to get into too much more detail. Private sector versus public sector, science and research. Yes, I have already made some mention of that. Where Anuj says about Amazon being socialist. No, you misunderstand me. You read Leigh Phillips. He makes a very important point. What Amazon demonstrates is that the problem, distribution problem of how to get, which is a purely mechanical question, of where to get goods from commodity, from supplier A to consumer B. They have solved it on an enormous scale, which socialism couldn't do. It's also true that Soviet Union had a lot of shortages. But Amazon being socialist is not what I said. Obviously, Jeff Bezos is a disgusting fellow. He's a horrible fellow, blah, blah, blah. But it is not about their production technique and their operational processes that are there. That is precisely the contradiction. These developed in the context of private capital, but it is without the ownership. If that were no longer the case, then what Amazon has developed is of value to the future, of a more just and equitable future. Think about it. That Madhava has my point. Thank you, Madhava. Good. Atkir has posted all watched over by machines of loving grace. Hey, you guys are amazing. So, planned economy can actually work. Jacobin man. That's Leigh Phillips, I guess. Shija has posted that. Thank you, Shija. Well, I must say, I must thank, as we get to the end of this, I must thank my colleagues and students of TISS now in other parts of the country. A lot of this we thought about together. We used to kick it around together, discuss it together. So I owe a lot to them for what I was able to say today. What is that about Pratish's question? Do you have any comment about population density of cities and its relation to any kind of personal? I agree. So if you have a higher population density, there are all kinds of advantages. Rural areas with sparse populations are not where innovation happens, are not the centers of culture. They're the bloody backwoods. Even in advanced countries and even in our country, you know, there is a real deprivation in intellectual and other terms. Overcoming that divide is far in the future. So urban agglomerations, even going back to classical pre-industrial urbanism, is very responsible for intellectual activity, for innovation, for new ideas, the city-states of Europe, yes. But there is a price to be paid, and it was paid. People like Marx paid it in his personal life. It's a horrible, disgusting, polluted city. He lost 3 of his children to disease. Everybody died of disease. And in fact, the development of the sewerage and water supply of Britain, of London and Paris, were great advances in engineering. So, it's always, there is a contradiction at the heart of it. Getting hold of that contradiction is the key to understanding what is happening. So, yes, we need density, but we also need cleanliness, hygiene. We need ways of warning about epidemics. We need ways of handling such epidemics. Okay. I don't think I look forward to a society where for the next 250 years, we don't shake hands with anybody, or you don't hug a friend when we see him or her because of what? Of some virus. That's not a future I look forward to. Land use change and deforestation with zoonosis. Oh, this is, you know, UNEP trying to make hay while the sun shines. You know? It's really, it's... If you would send me a copy of the poster, I'd be delighted. They're no different from Rob Wallace, you know, the guy who wrote Big Flu, Big Farms or whatever. Really pretty pathetic. You know, the UNEP, in order to push its agenda on climate change and trying to say that agriculture and land use, etc., are as responsible for climate change as industry, have really gone a bit over the board. And this is, they're really trying to use the current crisis to push their agenda. Really, I didn't think they would stoop so low. Very good, Mr. Victoria, number 70, has a very good stomach. Are there? Okay. That is a good point. That is a good summary. Thank you. Like I said, I owe it to some of these guys. Supply chain optimization achieved by Amazon. Correct. What UNEP agenda? Look at climate change and land. The special report of the IPCC. Look at the Third World Network's report of the negotiations on summary for policymakers of that report. You'll find it on the Third World Network website. So that you'll get an idea of what I'm talking about. Okay, Abid.
Yes, yes.
Pratish, have I gone on long enough?
I think
enough?
You have answered most of the questions, if not all. So I think we can wind up now with the Q&A session. Yes. Thank you, Professor Jayaraman, for this excellent lecture. I would just briefly summarize what he talked about in the session for the benefit of the listeners. He, Professor Jayaraman, talked about the history of science, and one key takeaway from the lecture is the necessity of scientific knowledge and practices to be democratized so as to realize its true potential. Though science and technology is socially produced, the benefits of it often tend to get appropriated for private gain due to the asymmetric social relations of production under capitalism. Professor Jayaraman rightly called out the romanticism of nature and environmentalists who see only clean skies of a lockdown and not the hardship of millions below it. This is from a recent post that he made on social media. The centrality of production and science in addressing the environmental question, which is intimately tied to the questions of social justice and distribution, is something we should all keep in mind. Thank you, Professor Jayaraman, once again for this excellent lecture. We hope to have another session with you soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the listen. Yes. Yes.
Okay. Goodbye, all. Take care and be safe above all. Very important. Be safe. Goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you. For the listeners, you can follow both the comments on different social media channels, and all the lectures here will be uploaded on platforms like Spotify, where you have to search for both the comments. We would like to hear about your feedback, and you can register it in the Google form circulated in the text channel itself. Pratish will be reposting it. We will be resuming our Marks in Political Economy lectures by Professor Venkatesh Atreya tomorrow, same time, 9 p.m. Hope to see you all. Good night.